Tonight, I will be talking about right effort, since there's an abundance of effort and energy, as I mentioned before, 9 of them. So we'll isolate a nice little grouping of 4 called the right efforts. And these are, it's a bit of a cheat because it's also found in the Eightfold Path under right effort, and they count that as an extra right effort. So it's actually the drop-down menu in the Noble Eightfold Path under right effort. And it's set aside as an independent teaching, which gives you a sense of the importance of right effort. There's 2 of them basically extracted from the Eightfold Path and given their own little theater, and that is right effort and right mindfulness. Right mindfulness being the 4 foundations of mindfulness, right effort being the 4 right efforts. There is another little set of efforts as well, another 4 efforts. It's hard to, there's not a lot of difference between them. But these are the Samapadana are found in the 37 requisites of enlightenment. And there's another set of 4 just called the 4 exertions, which I might actually talk a little bit about because, after all, there's only 37 requisites to talk about in 6 days, so I thought I'd throw some extras in. So this is extraordinarily important. It's infused into every aspect of the Dhamma. You just can't go anywhere without right effort. And why I'm so emphasizing this is that quite often with the emphasis on mindfulness, it's usually referred to as just simple observation of that things are impermanent, that your body is impermanent, your feelings, your thoughts, and whatever rises and passes away. And that's the function of mindfulness in a lot of presentations of it. But really, what's happened there is that mindfulness has been extracted and looked at, especially in things like Abhidhamma, where there's just a definition of what mindfulness is, but unfortunately you can't use that as what mindfulness does. Because mindfulness, the description of what mindfulness is not adequate to define what it does in the Eightfold Path. It's always qualified by other factors of the path. So whenever you look at any of these aspects of the teachings, like metta or mindfulness or samadhi or right speech or any of these things, you always have to understand it can't be extracted from the Eightfold Path. It can't be regarded without reference to its place in the Eightfold Path. It's like a chapter in a novel by Dickens. You know, it can't just remove that. You wonder, it'd be very odd if you just take out one scene in a Shakespeare play and just look at that. Just so that's Shakespeare, is it? No, it doesn't make any sense unless it's within the context of the whole play. So all of these things have to be put in their context, and you'll see this very widely happening because it takes quite a bit of learning and practice about the Eightfold Path. It's a large body of material, and sometimes people are quite eager to get teaching things, mindfulness and so forth, and they really don't have the full context of it. So they're teaching something that is hanging in space. It's unsupported. It's not surrounded. It doesn't have its context. It has effect. Obviously, people take these mindfulness courses and are quite, it changes them and so forth, but it could do more if one is pleased with that. Just think, if you could put it in the full context of what the Buddha is teaching, then imagine that you could always ask for more in these things. So this right mindfulness, right concentration, always are in the context of what precedes it, and that is right effort. And right effort is in the context of right view. So the whole of right view, that very simply to put the teaching of the Buddha, the essential teaching of the Buddha, he basically said, I only teach two things. There's suffering, there's an end to it. But since you're not an intuitive genius, you need two more truths to get you to the end. So the two are that, why is this suffering happening? And then how do you get to the end of it? So the essence of all of the Buddha's teaching is just these, like the first and the third truth, but you need a little guidance and help to flesh it out. So second and fourth are added. And right effort is to express that, to get you from there's suffering, there's an end to it. And if you simply practice any one of the path factors, they will not give you the entire, they won't give you the results. The Buddha is when you read the suttas and so forth, he's very, what you would call, recursive. Not that he curses a lot, but it keeps folding back on itself, repeating itself. There's little microcosms which contain larger elements, and the smaller elements are found in the larger elements. It keeps folding back on itself. And you will see him sometimes say, you know, if one who develops the four foundations of mindfulness develops the path. But he says that, but it really means that it's in the context of the path, and that when you fulfill it, it leads on to something, actually. And then he says, because it fulfills the seven factors of enlightenment, but the seven factors of enlightenment fulfill the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path fulfills the ending of suffering. So I think he's using a lot of clickbait, actually. I mean, all good teachers do, you know. Got to get people's attention, you know. So he will say something, you know, that's a little, you think it's against his teaching, just to catch people's attention. And then it will unfold it and explain it so that you understand. And he calls that a special language. He calls it, in this doctrine and teaching, in this Dhamma, this word, this is how we use these words. So he takes words that are used in common conversation, and he gives them new context. He just gives special definitions for them. And that is very important, because if you're very literal with these things, you don't understand their context, then you will misunderstand the Dhamma. So, right effort is critical and is what informs mindfulness, and mindfulness supported by right effort leads on to samadhi, and that's how you know that you've done it successfully. If it doesn't, it hasn't reached its fulfillment. You haven't developed it enough. So let us talk about right effort, and I'll throw in the four right exertions as well, a little bit. They're just slight variation on it. But the first is prevention. So there's two that are about negative things, primarily about the hindrances, the problems, the explicit sufferings and mistakes that we make, emotional mistakes. Because it's not merely about the way we think, it's about how this thinking feels. And so the prevention, of course, is to do with the five hindrances. And so desire and hostility are the first two, agitation and sloth the second two, and then doubt, not all doubt, but certain kinds of doubt are problematic, and you can't decide whether you should take that job or not, how to deal with a relationship, whether you should go back to school or not. You know, you get caught at the crossroads, the very uncomfortable feeling. And we do this to ourselves, and some people are always at the crossroads. They're always asking. You probably have friends that are always trying to get you to make a decision for them or solve their dilemma. You know, you're split. You're at the fork in the road. So this is how you would describe what doubt is. There's two ways to go, and the person doesn't have the information to make the decision. At the same time, it's precarious to stay where you are. So it's a very uncomfortable feeling. This is actually at the root of anxiety. This is probably primarily what anxiety is. Anxiety, so, you know, this idea of that animals and humans, in a sense, the essence of our evolution is fight or flight. Which one do we do? Do we run to save ourselves or stay and deal with the situation to protect or what we have? And either one, if you can commit to either one, it's all right, you can fully commit to it. But what anxiety is that you can't decide which one, to run or stay, and you're caught in the middle of it. And that's very close to doubt. And people are walking around, caught between running and fighting, as they walk down the sidewalk. You know, this is what anxiety is. You're caught. You don't know whether to go forward or backwards, and you can't make a decision. So that's anxiety, is this suspended judgment that can't decide how to resolve this. So these hindrances have to be dealt with, and dealt with preferably first by prevention. And the techniques of prevention are so important to learn. So I'm just going to mention here this other set of four right efforts, which are very, very close to these ones. But interestingly, the first one, prevention, what the explicit instructions for prevention on these four efforts or exertions is called samvara, or sense restraint. So sense restraint as a way of stopping trouble before it starts. And this is what the advice to monks on going on alms round, the Buddha says, you know, you've had your nice meditation in the morning. You've got some nice samadhi, you've got some now you can't just stay in samadhi all the time. You got to go get some food in town. Now you have to walk through town, and it could be all kinds of what towns are. There's all kinds of towns. How are you going to preserve your quality of beautiful emotion that you've developed? It might be loving kindness. Or just might be the afterglow of serenity. You know, your mind is clear, your heart is warm, And now you're going to go through the village. How should you preserve this good quality? How should you prevent the arising of hostility or desire? Because you're going to be seeing various sights. You're going to sights and sounds, smells, tastes, touches. And so the Buddha urges sense restraint, which is not closing your eyes as you walk along, because you will end up in a ditch, but to disregard or not take note of either the sign of the attractive or beautiful, or the sign of the fault, the ugly. You are not to, well, see, this is, most people, maybe even more so with intelligent people who have opinions, are walking through life, glancing around and having opinions about faults of this and the faults of that, how that street would be nicer if they put proper signs out, and if that, oh, this one, I want to live on this street, the houses are really nice, very peaceful, so forth. That's not only done, but encouraged and appreciated. That's a whole column in the New York Times. I mean, it's a book. It's all what people do all the time. But by doing this, they're rousing the hindrances. And this requires, though, of course, it's what we call yoniso manasikara. When you regard things, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, and even ideas, if you regard them without wise attention, that is ayoniso manasikara, unwise attention, you will exaggerate the faults, you will see the fault, bring it forth, and with that will be accompanied negative emotion, usually some form of irritability or even outright anger or hate even, if you attend unwisely to the faults of the world, and if you attend unwisely to that which you regard as beautiful, it will produce a sense of desire, craving, wanting, lust. And so that will ruin your lucid samadhi mind, that will dissolve your metta. The Buddha just gives that as the first right effort under this secondary list. Sambhara, this restraint of the senses. And the restraint of the senses is to regard without comment. So you see things that are the world regards as ugly, etc., that which the world regards as desirable and beautiful, but you're very interested in not commenting on it, not investing in the sign. So what happens is we don't just see an object as an object, we actually see, we extract a judgment about it, which is called a sign, the sign of the fault in the object. There is, intrinsically, the fault is a creation of the mind. It's something you invest into the object. And so he's warning against that. So that is one of the most effective ways of prevention. And it's a great way to just practice in the morning when you have to step out the door, to say, let's see if I can manage restraint of the senses, the non-investment in the sign of the ugly, the fault, or the beautiful, and see if I can get to where I'm going, the grocery store or to work, and see what the effect is on your mind. And for the monks, the Buddha is saying, monks, keep your eyes maybe about 6 feet in front of you, kind of like as if you were a farmer plowing in a field. Like farmer keeps his eyes on just where the front of the plow meets the earth, soil. So keep your eyes there. you're not to be totally fixated on that. You do have to know when to make the turn to the next road and so forth. But you have to have a more panoramic awareness as well. So that's focused awareness. That would be mindfulness, and you can be intensely mindful. But at the same time, you have to be aware, oh, there's a water buffalo coming my way. It had to be in Thailand. Occasionally, on Amsterdam, weird things happen in villages. And one of the weird things is a water buffalo fight in the middle of the road. You're in this dirt street, barefoot, slogging through it, little villagers with offering rice and so forth, and there's water buffaloes everywhere. And occasionally, they take some sort of animosity towards each other, and they lock horns. And there's a lot of tension at that point, because one of them is going to realize the other one is stronger, and then they're going to break and run frantically in any direction. So if you're carefully watching the point of the plow and you're plowing into the water buffalo fight, it could be big trouble for you. There's some humorous stories about what happens when the buffalo runs. There's all kinds of events in life. I mean, just walk down a street in Portland, for instance. Yes, make sure you're paying attention. You know, panoramic awareness. There's stuff happening. So you can have those two kinds of awareness. You can have focused awareness and panoramic awareness. This is sampajanya, with this word sampajanya. Also, your robe is on correctly. This is, you actually have a rule. Monks, when you go outside the monastery, put your robes on correctly. I want you to put them on parimandala. Pari means around, mandala is mean nice and symmetrical. So get your robes nice and properly put on, you know. That's a overall awareness of what, you know, as a social being and also as a representative, like you're a walking signboard with a, you got your robes, you're a sign. Actually, the Buddha calls you a sign. People see this, especially in, of course, in a Buddhist country, the instant recognition, even on the corner of your eye, there's a monk there, and that triggers something in the mind. Even in this country, you look a little different, and people think, what is that? What? That's some sort of religious thing, you know? And that's going to go on in the mind. But if that's a eccentric and disheveled religious figure, it might be somewhat disappointing. But if they're walking mindfully in a collected fashion with their robes parimandala, then it might be enough to think, you know, I gotta find out what's going on there. Maybe I talk to that guy, you know, what's this about, you know? Who are you? What is that? Or maybe you know what it is, but I think, you know, I gotta start meditating. I gotta write. They look very serene. I wonder, I'd like some of that as well. So this is the sampajanya, both sati, and which is more focused awareness, and sampajanya. But notice that sati is not merely focused awareness. It's focused awareness in the context of Buddhism. And so one part is the context of, for a monk, it's the context of Vinaya. You're being specifically asked to walk in a certain way, to wear your robes in a certain way. And it's because you are being observed by other beings, and that, so this is you can teach other people without speaking. You're just by your presence and the way you're walking. It's been registering on people's consciousness. So mindfulness and all of the factors are always in a context, and they're in the context, if it's pure meditation, of the Dhamma, But there's another element to life, which is that this is, the Buddha could have just stayed sitting in bliss under the Bodhi tree after his enlightenment, but he decided to make the necessary effort to actually make an organization which would assist people who are not spiritual geniuses, virtuosos, that could go off and do this on their own, to progress and be helped by the development of the Sangha. And of course, what we call the parisa, the community of the monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen. And also people who are outside of that group, who are not convinced of the Dhamma or have any faith in it, but they can benefit in different ways as well. So there's a context for your inner work, your mindfulness, and right effort is a critical part of that. And then there's a context, your behavior, how you walk and talk and interact with other people, and including for lay people. So there's much advice. Of course, first of all, the five precepts, ethical behavior and speech, and responsibility, and being responsible towards yourself as well. For instance, not indulging in intoxicants. And then all kinds of other secondary behavior, like going to a monastery, listening to Dhamma talks. Very good. You all get an A. And then reflecting on Dhamma as well, and bringing into the social, like the social element. How do you relate to your fellow workers? If you're the employer or the director, or whether you're working with somebody or for somebody, and your personal relationships, your intimate relationships, your family relationships, all of these things are in this context and right effort has to apply, because the prevention, I mean, you're all of us, not just monks who are meditating all the time, are obliged to deal with these five hindrances, because they undercut the possibility of maintaining your basic sila, your basic virtue in life. So prevention of the arising of these negative emotions is important. So that he shows you one very specific technique there, this sense restraint. There are others. Just starting off the day, I mean, with 5 minutes of saying, you know, what's the point of getting angry? I mean, the world does what it does. By being disapproving of it, being angry about it, has no effect on it. So you determine that on your drive to work today, you will practice road love. Road love. It's the opposite of road rage. I mean, if you keep this up, so this is, how do these incidents happen with the road rage, where somebody jumps out of the car and shoots somebody else or breaks their windshield or they have a fist fight on the street? Because it's a gradual buildup. It didn't just happen that day. The person didn't drive in equanimity for their whole life and then suddenly burst into rage. No, it was not being concerned with, you know, how some people, they're muttering under their breath as they drive. They're like, man, you idiot, you, as if anybody could hear them. So then they're gesturing and honking, and this is going somewhere. You're actually developing and building up, and you can do the opposite. You can think, what am I thinking? You know, they all have a life which is, if I really understood it, I'd have a lot of sympathy for them. Life ain't easy. Maybe the work they do is not easy. The relationships are falling apart and everything. May they be well. And if you practice that and you're like that, you may even make the newspaper. You might, in the middle of this sweltering traffic jam is going nowhere, everybody is raging, you get out of your car, walk over, and hug somebody. Road love incident. The Portland Tribune. Road love incident. So these things incline to a certain way. And so this is what right effort is. And it's the harnessing. The mindfulness as a mere tool of observation is not adequate. It's always harnessed with the right effort. It's in the right direction with the right instructions. It's an ethical feature. And it alarm bells go off when you drift into the... If your mindfulness, your memory, your remembering of the teachings are there, then when you drift into these hindrances, you will know it. So that's the second part of this prevention. And that is removal. So that's the second of the right efforts. Is so you didn't manage to prevent it. It has arisen, and then there's removal, which I recommend that you either read the Sutta on Five Methods for Removing Problematic Thoughts or Emotions, or listen to a talk by me called Five Ways of Removing Problematic Emotions. What's it called? I forget the name of the talk, anyway. I spend quite a bit of time on this because it's one of the most underrated of the teachings of the Dhamma. It's just so much emphasis on mindfulness and kind of this soft, non-judgmental awareness or something like this, but it's really very important that you realize that the Buddha is giving very specific instructions about how to, if you have one of these hindrances, not to just observe it, not just be aware of it or watching it. There's specific instructions about how to remove them and all kinds of clever methods. And the methods are arranged in order of which one should be used first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. I mean, if you're... You might have to go to some extreme if, you know... Your temper is flaring and you're about to say something that you will regret or even get into a physical encounter, then you got to use whatever methods you can to suppress that. You can't just get it out, you know. That's bad advice. So there's a nice little list of methods for removing these negative emotions. It would take too much tonight to go into it, but next is the positive ones. And so your right effort is the encouragement to plant seeds of positive mental and emotional states. And primarily, this is the reference to the seven factors of enlightenment. And here's where we get a connection to another menu, which we will talk about, because it's one of the 37. So the ones that you want to prevent and remove are basically the five hindrances. The ones that you want to plant, in other words, put the seeds in of, because they're not necessarily there, but you're deliberately trying to encourage them, find out what they are first, and there are seven factors of enlightenment. Mindfulness, investigation of Dhamma, energy, joy, tranquility, samadhi, concentration, and equanimity, in that order. Those are the ones that you're attempting to initiate, and if you get them going, then your next duty is to deepen and increase them. These are what mindfulness is being utilized for. You can't do any of these things if you can't pay attention. But what is the purpose of your capacity to pay attention? Is it to pay attention to anything? Like, there's lots of people very good at paying attention. They just pay attention to anything. But you might think, well, you know, paying attention to a tennis ball, or, you know, people have these little hobbies and these little things they spend a lot of time paying attention to. And they really, they can, hours they pay attention to it. But you think, it's not a really good use of life, like TikTok, it's going by here. And I don't think I want to play that little board game all day long. It's just seems to me a terrible waste of life. Is there something more to it? They have mindfulness, but it's not right mindfulness. Right mindfulness is harnessed to the purpose of the fulfillment of this ending of suffering. It's its fundamental purpose. And so that is, he's giving you this, here's what you need to cultivate, here's what has to go. Preferably, it doesn't arise to begin with, but if it arises, here's how you deal with it, here's how you get rid of it, and here's what you're to welcome in. Here's what you're to initiate and to develop and cultivate until you can't ask for more. And by the way, part of this, another type of sort of right effort is called chanda. And that's right desire. Desire is a part of the path. You might have the misunderstood idea that you shouldn't have any desire, you know, desire to get rid of things. It's all about getting rid of things, and that's a desire. And just, no, the Buddha is very big on chanda, which is right desire, and right desire to get rid of some stuff and to get other stuff and to keep other stuff and to deepen other stuff. And you're to have this desire. By the way, we'll get to that. It's in another list. It's the four roads to power. One of the fours. Very rarely talked about. I've never given a talk on the four roads to power, the four bases of power, but in this retreat I will. Yeah. Anyway, chanda is one of those, but I thought I'd bring it in now because it's very clear that right effort really means right effort, and you have to have desire for this ending of suffering, and that's your motivation. It's very important. Be highly motivated for this. Because you will hear all kinds of teachings like, just like, don't do anything. Like, desire is the problem, so stop this desire. Desire to get rid of things, to get this, to get change, and to be this and that. No, there's nothing to do with the teachings of the Buddha. That is, there are a school, schools of that kind of, you'll hear it, but it really has nothing to do with the traditional teachings of the historical Buddha. He's very big on aspiration, basically strong desire and strong effort, and very specific about techniques that you can harness to overcome these negative emotions. And he spends a great deal of time as well explaining what's the problem with these emotions, making sure you understand that they are problematic, that they aren't satisfactory. So that I really don't have time to go into those, but just to finish off is that the deepening process continues until you really don't need any further desire because you're there. You're missing nothing. So the ending of suffering is not just the ending of suffering, but it's the presence of something else. It's the fulfillment of these seven factors, which are all absolutely delightful. And a specific emotion of joy is mentioned in there. And the other specific emotions are the more, you know, really deep, refined, exquisite serenity, stillness, and perfect balance. Exquisite. So all the range from joy to exquisite stillness is where one is attempting to keep the needle into the green zone there. And by the way, you're not just watching the rise and fall of the seven factors of enlightenment and the five hindrances. The needle is not swinging past there, and you're standing somehow detached from your own attachments, watching the needle swing into anger, but being detached from your anger, no. Again, bad idea, wrong idea, throw it out. It's the needle remains in the green zone, seven factors of enlightenment. Doesn't go into the five hindrances, even though both the five hindrances are impermanent and the seven factors of enlightenment are impermanent, but it doesn't mean that you don't have any preferences about this and that you don't have any control over it. You're developing control over it, and you have a very strong preference for remaining in the region of the seven factors of enlightenment. And if you develop enough, you can remain in there 24 hours a day till the rest of your life. And that's what the Buddha is urging you to. Those hindrances should, if they're not uprooted at their very base, where you no longer generate them under any circumstances, at least you have enough skill and so forth that although the roots have not been, you haven't uprooted the basis of them, what are they called, the samyojana as the roots of these, but you don't allow them to rise up into emotional structures because you have a lot of skill in your awareness and your mindfulness and your prevention structures. So that's what the Buddha is advocating. It's not a philosophy about the impermanence of the universe. That just is one of the things he's pointing out. It's all impermanent. And what? You're just supposed to drift around with that? No, it's very, very explicit. This is emotional transformation. This is transformation at the very roots of human nature. So that is it for the four right efforts. Of course, they will come up interlinked with other things in future talks when I talk about the Eightfold Path and the Seven Factors of Enlightenment and the Four Roads to Power and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, because I've only talked really about the 10, the five faculties, the five powers, and the four, and so that's only 14. We got how many to go? Mathematician, can you do 37 minus 14? What, how many? Thank you, 23. Okay, that's it.